TSN 1290, CFRW Winnipeg. All sports.
This is my spot.
All the time. A division of Bell Media.
If you want to know the real deal about the three, we're going to take it with triple chop. We're going to bring you up to speed. Yeah.
TSN 1290 presents the Illegal Curve Hockey Show with Drew Mandel, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg.
Manitoba, and for all those joining us live at tsn1290.ca, good morning, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We have a jam-packed 2 hours ahead for you this morning. Coming up in about 15 minutes' time, Andrew Gross is going to join us. Following him, Aaron Portsline is going to join us. We have all your latest Winnipeg Jets news, starting with the Tobias Enstrom contract extension that went into play yesterday. Ezra, have you not figured out how the headphones work yet?
I'm actually going to... What are you doing? You keep turning my volume up full blast.
I can explain to you off air in the next commercial break which one your dial is and which one everybody else's dial is.
Boys, first off, good morning.
You've already done that twice. The show just started, and you've already turned my volume up full blast in my ears twice.
I wasn't here last week, and I want to make sure that all the fans listening out there can hear me.
By making us deaf in our own ears. Is that how it works?
Well, I mean, you guys, you're acting like you're too old here. You got to turn up the volume a little bit.
You're the one who just turned 30.
And then you hurt your back on
and
a canoeing trip.
And you hurt your back. True or false, you were complaining about having back pain as you were on your way to the studio this morning.
Well, first of all, Drew, 30's the new 20. I mean, pick up a Jay-Z album. Let's go here.
I don't know what that means.
Jay-Z had a song, 30's the new 20.
Oh, okay.
So, that's fine. I mean, the volume has to be up. We have a lot to talk about here. We've got, obviously, Enstrom's contract to talk about. The Olympics have started today.
Let's talk about the Olympics.
I mean, we've got to be loud here.
Okay, that's fine. Just don't fiddle with the mics anymore. Anyways, that's Ezra Ginsberg. On his left is Richard Pollock. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Illegal Curve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com. Let's start with the Tobias Enstrom contract extension. Came down at about 12:20 or so yesterday afternoon. Toby Enstrom back under contract with the Winnipeg Jets. 5-year contract extension worth 28.75 million dollars, an average annual cap hit of $5.75 million. We talked about Toby Enstrom earlier in the week on the website illegalcurve.com. We went through the options available to the Winnipeg Jets. Sign him now or trade him now is what we said. The team said sign him. The team did sign him. Your thoughts on the contract extension?
I thought it was a good deal for both sides, really. I think, Drew, what it came down to is I thought negotiations would probably start at 4 years, $24 million, $6 million a year. I think when you look at it, I think Enstrom probably gave up maybe about $750,000 about a year. I think maybe even about $750,000 a year on the market. I think he probably could have got 6.5 from another team, you know, on the open market next summer.
Right.
Having said that, I would hazard to guess that negotiations probably started around 6-24, and that one side wanted to push it for another year and for another year of security. And to move
You mean 4-24.
Right, 4-24.
4 years, $24 million. Dollars.
$6 million per year, and then one team wanted to move it for security to one side for 5 years, and then the other side said, okay, I'm assuming Enstrom's side wanted to move another year.
Enstrom's side wanted to get the extra year, and the Jets countered and said, we'll give you that extra year, but it's going to cost you $250,000 a year in order to
achieve that. That's what I was speculating as to how it happened. But overall, ballpark, I think that it was a pretty fair deal for both sides. I have no issue with it. The Jets had to sign him or trade him. They signed him. I think it's a good move. You know, you can ask the question, will the Jets be contenders during the time period that he's under contract? But we don't know what the Jets have been offered. And I'm assuming they went out there and kind of checked to see what the market bear for somebody like that. Because they would be foolish to not do it.
Well, I asked Chevy that on the conference call yesterday. And, of course, he's not going to be honest about that answer. Yeah. Nor would I expect him to be. But, you know, I said to him, did the team explore what Enstrom would be worth on a trade market? And, of course, he said no because, you know, anything else at that point.
They'd have been foolish not to because you want to know what your assets are worth.
That's right.
And you want to know how much you can get for him. But if they couldn't get a ton for him, the value he has to the team is immense. Obviously, he's their number one left side defenseman. He plays with Byfuglien. He's secure for Byfuglien. Puck moving defensemen are hard to come by. He can do a lot of things. He's a good defenseman. He's a really good defenseman. He gets points. He can play a lot of minutes. I think he could actually be even better on the penalty kill if given the opportunity. He logs big power play time. As compared to the contracts that we threw out as comparables, Brian Campbell, Brent Burns, mm-hmm. the recently signed Matt Carl, his numbers compare actually favorably to all three. And so maybe he could have got even more. But the point is, if you sign him, you're signing him to a fair deal. The worst comes to worse. You know, you have him on a four-year deal, three-year deal, and in 2 years you realize, oh, you know what, it's not going to work. We need to do some things. You can trade him then.
Right.
It's a classic case of signing him to actually increase it. Similar to kind of what Hemsky on a bigger scale, the Oilers can get more for Hemsky now that he's signed than if he's a pending UFA. So the Jets had two options, and I think I have absolutely no issue with the option they took. I think it was a good decision. And, you know, the question of whether or not they'll contend during this tenure, it's an interesting question. It's 6 years now, because you tack on the five to the year he already has. And by the way, those are separate cap hits. So next year he's at 3.75 on the books. The year after he's at 5.75. For the next 5 years he's at 5.75. So that's an issue.
It's worth noting, and it's not 100% sure if this is crystal clear or not, yes. But CapGeek is saying that there's a no-movement clause right. attached to this new right. contract. So we haven't seen that really anywhere else, but CapGeek is usually pretty reliable.
It is. I don't love the no-movement clause. I know most players signing long-term deals as a year are putting them in there, but it does restrict your ability, obviously, to trade the guy, and he has that control, and also put him in the minors if you're going to do that, but you're not going to do that. But overall, you know, the Jets had, as I mentioned, two options, and this option gives them a lot of flexibility, keeps a young core. He's a good age, remember. You're getting him from 27 through 34 here, 28, 34. Those are good years for defensemen, and he's a smaller defenseman. So with 34, maybe you worry a bit about him wearing down. You know, I've talked a lot about it on the website about a guy like Brian Rafalski. Like, a guy like Enstrom would be great for Detroit, who I think would have been way after him next summer. And Rafalski, a guy like that, Ezzy, great player, smaller guy, offensive guy. Marty Brodeur saved years for his career, and he's still retired, I think, at 36.
Mm-hmm.
So the smaller guys sometimes do have a tendency to wear down earlier, so you get out of it at 34, you reevaluate.
This shouldn't become an albatross.
No.
Given everything that we've seen of Tobias Enstrom's game, and of course injuries can flare up and make things a lot more difficult than you would expect. But everything about this says that defensemen, they mature later, they develop a little bit later. Mm-hmm. You're going to get a lot of quality years at a very reasonable price for Tobias Enstrom.
The best part of this deal is that the Jets avoid a Ryan Suter situation.
Yes.
They avoid Zdeno Chara situation.
Which is exactly what Richard spoke about.
And they're locking up a guy along with Andrew Ladd, along with Dustin Byfuglien, along with Andre Pavlik, hopefully with Evander Kane long term, and then you throw in Zach Bogosian, you throw in Blake Wheeler. Those are your seven guys.
The core of your team.
The core of your team. And obviously Ladd and Byfuglien have 4 years left, whereas Enstrom's going to have six. Kane might have six.
I mean, the question is, though, as you're locking, I want to talk a little bit about that. You know, the team's going to lock in all these guys on the roster.
Are you saying, is your question, are they good enough?
Yeah, I mean, there's an assumption that everybody's going to get locked up, big, you know, Little next year and Wheeler, obviously, and then Bogosian. And let's not lock up everybody here for long-term deals if the core hasn't really done too much. I mean, I don't understand why you want to. I assume they're not going to be jumping at signing Little because he's overrated. So the question is Wheeler, and then what's Wheeler? You don't rush to sign Wheeler here. You don't rush to sign him. Wait.
I mean, rush to sign him is he's an RFA after next season.
Exactly.
Pardon me, after this coming season.
Yeah, sorry. So I mean, that's
and exactly. He's a little older. He might maybe get a 3 or 4 year deal as opposed to a 6 year deal.
You're right. People are talking that Bogosian's next. Personally?
You wait.
I want to see more from Bogosian too.
Well, that's fine. I mean, and you're right. And I think there's a big difference between locking up your UFAs a year ahead of time and your RFAs. Your RFAs, I mean, unless you're Shea Weber and, you know, barring a huge offer sheet, you know, you still control a lot of the RFA's movement.
The truth is
arbitration or anything else.
Yeah, I mean, most RFA contracts that if, you know, people are worried about offer sheets for a guy like Bogosian, for example.
Yeah.
The truth of the matter is, if they're going to be paying him Shea Weber money, you might want to take the four picks. But if it's not Shea Weber money, generally speaking, it's worth matching and not something to worry about.
That's
and
right.
People have to also understand quickly on that point, as an aside, to be able to sign an offer sheet, to be able to tender one for whatever scale, and the scale goes up, obviously, as more money you include, you need to have four first-round picks, but not four first-round picks.
Your own.
And you need, so if you're going to sign a lesser scale deal for the first, second, and third, or whatever that compensation is, you need to have your first, second, and third. So many teams actually are struck out of even tendering offer sheets because they don't have their own picks. So that's something to take into account, too. Offer sheets are rare, not only because of teams reticent to maybe put other teams in awkward positions and worry about retaliation later on, but also the fact that lots of teams don't have their draft picks.
That's right. Look, I'm not too concerned. I don't think, you know, if Zach Bogosian or Blake Wheeler don't get extended prior to the start of the season or even throughout the season, I don't consider that to be a problem. These aren't guys you're going to lose for nothing.
And
it's physically, it's almost impossible that you would lose any of these guys for nothing. Sitting there with, Tobias Enstrom, that's a guy you could have lost for nothing.
Exactly, and you can't lose him for nothing. Teams, and that's what I stressed in the article.
The Suter, the Chara problem.
And Remus will tweet that article out, but you can't, exactly. Teams can't make up for it. I mean, that's David Poyle's biggest crutch as a GM. He can't make a decision quick enough. Hartnell and Thiemann, and he trades right before free agency. He didn't get enough for them beforehand. He lost Suter for nothing. Ottawa lost Chara. Sure, they made the finals the next year, but they were set back for years after that. You know? Redden, the same thing. Redden was terrible, obviously, but the idea is you can't lose these guys for nothing.
If you lose a number one or a number two defenseman or a number one forward or a number two forward, you cannot easily replace those guys.
Well, you know, Richie, you mentioned Detroit. I mean, and that is a team that obviously is trying to fill the void of Nicklas Lidström. And not only can you not afford to lose Enstrom, you can't afford to not keep him. You have to, I mean, Tobias Enstrom obviously has his downfalls, but guys like that, I think he's better than Matt Carl. And I think his cap hit is a little bit less.
One of the things to do, when Drew and I were talking about this yesterday, and I mentioned this in the article as well, one of the things to take into account in terms of Carl Ezzy is that Carl's at 5.5 a year.
5.5 a year. Six-year deal, $33 million.
And Enstrom's at 5.75. One of the big keys is, well, Carl's a bigger guy.
Yeah.
And I think one of the keys to note there is that Carl's a bigger guy, and people say, you know, will associate bigger guy with more reliable. In this case, it actually is true. Carl doesn't miss any games.
Carl's missed 2 games in the past 3 years.
So I think that reliability factor does play into this analysis.
Yeah. Not that Toby Enstrom is, I mean, injury-prone by any stretch. He got the shoulder injury last year. Yeah. And on the conference call yesterday, the team spoke about how impressed they were with seeing how passionate and how hard he worked to get back into the lineup, how it killed him to be on the sidelines, you know, while he was out with that injury, and how hard he worked to get back in there. And they said that sort of dedication, seeing that dedication, and that, you know, is a big,
well, was a better big, get that dedication if you're going to give him $6 million a year.
Well, of course, but, you know, seeing that gave them the comfort in knowing that this is a guy they want around for the future for this franchise.
Well, this past year he broke his collarbone. I mean, that's a serious injury. He could have missed. He obviously missed 20 games. You can miss a lot more than that. I mean, that's a serious injury. Everyone remembers that hit. I believe it was against Florida.
Yeah.
But
he missed 20 games this past year. He missed 10 games the year before. 82 games in 09-10, 09-10, 82 games in 08-09, 82 games in 07-08. Yeah. So, I mean, you know,
I'm assuming, though, that those injuries came with more responsibility.
Probably.
Meaning that if you look at his stats, I mean, the past 3 years,
as his ice time increased,
even street ice times went up. Yeah.
And that's going to be a factor for Tobias Enstrom, is that he's not the biggest guy in the world, and the Jets will probably have to scheme it in such a way to protect him from getting into those difficult, aggressive situations.
And teams have such ways that, you know, a certain player will go back as in defense.
The Red
and
Wings
get the
protected Nicklas Lidström.
Exactly. And so that won't be an issue now, but later on probably will be an issue. Overall, the Jets got him at, I think, fair market value. If, you know, signing him now, you get him at fair market value, just about, right around there. They made a decision, which they needed to do. You trade him, or you sign him. They signed him, and now you're on to the still the key of the summer. And that's Evander Kane. And we've obviously talked about that at length, so we'll see what's next there.
Yeah. Let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Andrew Gross. He's the Rangers beat writer for the Record newspaper in New Jersey. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And the website is www.illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
Let's welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. He writes, he's the Rangers beat writer for the Record in New Jersey, Andrew Gross. Andrew, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
How are you doing today?
Doing very well. How about yourself?
Oh, you know, early morning here in New York, but doing all right.
That's good. Glad to hear it. Andrew, we got to start, obviously, with the Rick Nash deal. I mean, that's that was the news of the week. Well, for about an hour before the Yankees acquired Ichiro in New York. But, you know, did the Rangers get a bargain for Rick Nash?
Probably. Yeah, I think the way you would put it is they got Rick Nash at their price rather than, obviously, the Blue Jackets' price. But if you look at what the Rangers gave up, it wasn't anything that they were dearly holding on to. You know, they really liked Artie Anisimov as a player. But, you know, if you bring in Rick Nash, really, how much room is there, you know, for Artie to get minutes next season? Brandon Dubinsky off a down season. I mean, he had to be included in the trade because of salary considerations. And, you know, Tim Erickson could still well develop into a very good NHL defenseman. That's the projection for him. But from a Rangers standpoint, I don't think he was going to develop here just because, you know, Coach John Tortorella just, you know, it wasn't a match there. What Tim can do on the ice wasn't exactly what Torts was looking for on the ice. So he was an extra, I think, as far as the Rangers were concerned. And you know what? You give up a first-round pick, and, you know, sometimes those are very valuable, obviously. But, you know, that's 3-4 years down the road, possibly, and the Rangers are in win-now mode. So for the Rangers, yeah, it was at their price. So I guess you consider that a bargain.
Andrew, obviously Scott Housen kind of went to the Rangers, turned down the deal at the deadline. That probably was a better deal. Went around the league and came back to the Rangers. Housen got his job in the start in hockey through the Edmonton Oilers and Edmonton Oilers farm team, you know, led by Glenn Sather. Did their relationship have an effect at all in these negotiations, and maybe more of a positive effect, maybe kind of pushing him around a little bit in terms of Sather vis-a-vis Housen?
I don't know about pushing Scott around. You know, Glenn, and when I say Glenn, I'm really talking about his whole staff, but, you know, he's kind of a wily car dealer there at times. I mean, you see what he did to the Canadians a few years back, agreeing, you know, getting them to agree to take Scott Gomez and turning that into really Marion Cabrick, Ryan McDonough. Mm-hmm. It turned into Brandon Prost, who, you know, ironically, is back with the Canadians. So Glenn's made probably more decent big trades. I'll say more decent big trades than not recently. So I don't know about pushing around Scott. I will say that Glenn does have a comfort level. He likes trading with people he knows. Mm-hmm. You know, he looked down the list how many trades he's made with his old assistant Don Maloney out in Phoenix. Right. So there could be, you know, certainly a familiarity there that, you know, led to a comfort level in making this deal.
Andrew, obviously when the Rick Nash trade was completed, everyone started to visualize Rick Nash playing alongside Brad Richards. Do you think it's a foregone conclusion that Rick Nash lines up beside Brad Richards? And who else do you think is going to be on that top line? Obviously, Marion Gaborik is going to be injured for a little bit.
I'll never say a foregone conclusion with Torts because, you know, things we think are foregone conclusions are often blown up by the end of the first period. Coming into training camp last season, we all thought it was a foregone conclusion that you signed Brad Richards, and obviously you signed Brad Richards because Marion Gaborik needs a number one center. And that lasted about 9 games into the regular season, and then Torts really didn't come back to it until late in the season and then through the playoffs. I'm certainly thinking that, you know, when Torts is jotting down lines going into training camp with his staff, that's the projection that you have Richie in the middle and Nash on either side of his wing. You know what? I really think Chris Kreider, who'll be going into his rookie season, I really think he could snag that spot. Obviously, you know, Gabby's going to be back. You know, December are the estimates. There's a chance he could put those three together when he comes back, but I really think that Gabby and Nash will wind up separated to give him two really outstanding lines. I think it's going to be ultimately, I think it's going to be Richie and Nash because they've proven they can play together, but nothing is set in stone. But, you know, you're asking me, I say Kreider, Richie, and Nash at this point.
Andrew Gross covers the New York Rangers for the Record and Herald News, and he joins us on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show right now. Andrew, given the salary cap ramifications in acquiring Rick Nash, the team now has $22 million locked up in Nash, Richards, and Gabrick. Was there any trepidation on New York's end in taking on this this additional big contract?
Surprisingly, no. You know, Glenn was full speed ahead from the word get-go, and the salary cap implications never seemed to matter to him, and maybe it was because he knows that there's a new CBA coming up, and everything's getting blown up, and there could be rollbacks, and essentially, who knows what the landscape's going to look like, you know, 2-3 months from now. So I don't really think Glenn... That didn't deter the Rangers one bit. In fact, on the conference call in announcing the trade, Glenn made a point of saying that if you look at the financials, it was a complete wash, giving up Dubinsky and giving up Timmy Erickson, who, even though Erickson split the year really between the A and the NHL and only played 18 games for the Rangers, he was on the salary cap for $1.7 million. So, you know, that's a significant figure taken away. Doobie, obviously, you know, I think, what was he, at 4.2? You know, he had a high number, and then Artie was in the million, you know, and he's going to be looking for a new deal after this year. So the way the Rangers looked at it was they actually made out in terms of salary with the trade. Where that is sort of a fallacy is, you know, Erickson and, you know, Doobie only had three more years, and Isimov after this year. Those were shorter-term deals, and obviously Rick Nash is signed through 2018. So there are going to be long-range implications. But if you look at it, you know, Gabby will probably be gone, I would think, after this deal. You know, and that's in another two seasons. And, you know, so that's some money off the cap. So, no, I mean, a long answer, it didn't faze the Rangers one second.
You know, Andrew, you mentioned Gabrick. We were going to ask you about the injury concerns. You mentioned he's probably due back in December, and also about the contract and whether they see him coming back in a couple of years. But moving on to the team's back end, you know, last year we saw this team play in the playoffs, and obviously John Tortorella, who likes to ride his horses, was really riding his horses and would hardly trust his bottom two guys, especially when Sauer was injured and he didn't have him available. Doesn't the team still need to add a defenseman on the back? Obviously, you know, this team is one of the top teams in the league regardless, but does this team need to add another defenseman to really make that long run into the playoffs and take the next step?
Yeah, I think they went into this offseason with the objective of trying to bolster their defense. It hasn't happened. My sense is that the Rangers' next move is, you know, they'll be all in trying to get Shane Doan, you know, if Shane really is going to listen to offers and leave the Coyotes. That would be their next move, and that quite possibly could end the Rangers' offseason, you know, shopping list just because of financial considerations if they were able to get a Shane Doan. So, yeah, you know, you don't get everything you look for when you go into the offseason. You brought up Michael Sauer. And that's a huge question mark, and the Rangers certainly are not counting on Mike to come back, certainly at the start of the season. There's, you know, there's a lot of question marks about whether this guy really is going to be able to resume his career, you know, and that would be a pretty big blow because that's a top four defenseman you're talking about for the Rangers. So, yeah, it's a point of need, but I think the Rangers feel like, you know, they have, you know, at least to start the regular season, they're pretty well set. You know, they got their top two, Ryan McDonagh, Dan Girardi. Mark Stahl's going to have a full off season to train, which is something he did not have coming into last season. You know, his first game was the Winter Classic, and it was really not until the playoffs where he really started, you know, cranking on all cylinders like you'd expect from a Mark Stahl. So, I mean, you know, you got three guys who are all legitimate top two defensemen. So that's a, you know, they are kind of top heavy right there. But they filled it out. They re-signed Anton Stralman the other day. They're going to re-sign Michael Belzotto, and DZ is a top four defenseman. And you got Stu Bickel to come in and give you a few minutes in a fight. You know, probably one out of every two games. So there is defense there. They can go into the season with that. They just were looking to get a little bit, you know, a little bit deeper there.
Andrew, you mentioned Michael Delzato, and that segues perfectly into my question. I really like Michael Delzato, and I think he had a really good year last year. How are those negotiations progressing?
By all accounts, you know, the two sides are talking. I think now that, you know, I think the Rangers' first focus because of the arbitration hearing deadline was to get Anton Stralman done. You know, he had an arbitration hearing set for Tuesday, and they got him done for 2 years at $3.4 million. And now I think you move on to DZ, and you get that done with DZ's agent Wade Arnett. And you know what? I mean, DZ's kind of in a tough spot. He has no arbitration rights. He's a restricted free agent. After what happened with Shea Weber, you know, it would floor me if anyone's offering any offer sheets at this point. So I think they think they're in a really good spot. I don't see an issue getting a deal done for DZ by the time camp is scheduled to start. So, I think both sides are talking, and there is a deal to be done there.
You mentioned that situation. The Jets are in the same situation here in Winnipeg with Evander Kane. It seems like the team has all the leverage in that situation, so they can be a little bit more patient. You mentioned before, Andrew, Anton Stralman re-signing. I guess kind of going back to the question we had a few questions ago, if the team is, you know, so reliant on the top four and seemingly untrustworthy of other players on the back end, including Stralman, why give Stralman 1.7, and maybe why give him the second year?
I don't think it's they're distrustworthy of him. I just think this is sort of the way Torts coaches. He, you know, from the first day in New York, he said he believes in his best players being on the ice, mm-hmm. be it the top line or be it in the back end or, you know, obviously in net. So I think that's more a function of how John coaches than, you know, trusting, you know, the bottom two or three defensemen. Anton Stralman in the playoffs proved to be a very adequate, you know, guy to have on the ice. He got better and better, you know, since the Rangers signed him in November. And obviously the Rangers looked at him and said, this is a guy that, you know, that we think we can move forward with. They're not going to go back. Steve Eminger kind of filled that sixth, seventh mm-hmm. defenseman role for two seasons. I don't see him coming back, right. Even though he's, you know, Emmy's a great guy in the room and, you know, on the ice, he just doesn't stop. And he certainly gives you, you know, minutes in on the back end. But they just like Anton Stralman more, probably because he is able to move the puck, right. and he proved in the playoffs that he can produced on the power play. He had, with two goals, two assists on the power play, three goals, three assists overall in the playoffs. And, you know, I think he really earned a second year by what he did in the postseason because his role just increased a little bit, even though they were, like you said, riding the heck out of Brian McTunn and Dan Girardi mm-hmm. For a good portion of the playoffs. Anton Stroman's minutes increased as the playoffs went on, and I think there's certainly trust there, and I think they look at him as a guy, you know, who's going to be really good, you know, maybe the bottom, the third pair, you know, to really make that rather than just, you know, a throwaway third pair. To really make those some quality minutes when he's on the ice.
Final question, Andrew. John Tortorella, obviously much was made, probably too much made, about the style of play the Rangers were utilizing as they went through the playoffs last year to the conference final and lost in Game 6. Prior to that point, and obviously John Tortorella's tenure with Tampa Bay, he coached quite a different style. You know, the whole safe as death mantra, which has been talked about at length and with St. Louis and et cetera, those players in Tampa Bay. Should fans and onlookers expect Tortorella to change the style the Rangers were employing last playoffs based upon the acquisition of a top-end goal scorer like Rick Nash?
It's kind of a wishy-washy answer, but, you know, a little bit of yes, a little bit of no. And if you talk to John, and we asked him that question a lot last season, and whether it's revisionist history or not, he swears that the way the Rangers played is not significantly different than what he was doing in Tampa Bay. If you check the videotape, he had his guys blocking shots in Tampa Bay and grinding and going hard. But there certainly was a little bit more, you know, with Boyle in the back end, you know, getting out quicker and transitioning faster than he's been able to do, I think, with the Rangers. Mm-hmm. But now that you have Rick Nash, even though you do have Nash, I really think it's a matter of what you can get from the back end and getting the puck up ice quickly. Mm-hmm. So, if John doesn't think that that's happening, he is going to play it a little bit more conservatively. I think a huge factor will be Ryan McDonough's development. It seems like he's been around for a while, but really this is only going to be his second full season in the NHL, and he's still developing. I mean, I think there's a chance that Ryan McDonough is the Rangers' number one defenseman, like right now, going into the season. Mm-hmm. But he really is just going to get better. So, between him and, Mark Stahl and Anton Stralman distributes the puck very well. And certainly, Michael Delzato, when he comes back and he gets signed, the one thing that he got caught on, they got caught up doing, was maybe trying to be too aggressive in distributing the puck and in those home run passes. And I think DZ, as he matures, is learning the balance there of, when to go for the home run pass and when to take the safe pass. So I think he's going to be a much better puck distributor too. So, with Nash there and when Gabby comes back, I do think you'll see the Rangers trying to push it up the ice a little bit more. I don't think it will ever resemble the safest death in Tampa, mm-hmm. but it'll be a little bit closer this season, at least on paper.
Andrew Gross covers the New York Rangers for The Record and Herald News. Thanks very much for joining us this morning on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Anytime, guys. You have a great day.
You too, Andrew. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot, Andrew.
Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to Andrew Gross for having just joined us to talk about the Rick Nash trade from the Rangers' perspective. Coming up in about 7 minutes' time, Aaron Portsline from the Columbus Dispatch will give us the Rick Nash trade from the Columbus perspective. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Illegal Curve. And the website is www.illegalcurve.com. This segment of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show is brought to you by Carbone Coal-Fired Pizza, home of Canada's only coal-fired pizza oven. Taste the difference at Carbone Coal-Fired Pizza, 1580 Taylor Avenue, pizza baked, well done.
I bet they don't have any coal-fired pizza in London.
I have no idea. None whatsoever.
And if they do, these athletes, especially these cyclists that we're watching here, they shouldn't be eating any coal-fired pizza. Hopefully they're just drinking Gatorade.
What are you talking about?
I honestly am stunned that somebody has asked you to MC their wedding.
Yes.
Yeah, can we talk about this?
After the show today, yes, that's right, guys. I'm glad that you mentioned, I'd like to say hi to Aaron and Julie out there. Aaron DeGroote is a co-worker of mine. I'm going to be emceeing his wedding later today at Fort Garry Hotel.
I'll tell you what, Richard,
it makes some sort of sense. Because your wedding, if they're starting their wedding day, like they're going to have the world's biggest disaster of a wedding already. So everything after the wedding is going to be better than the wedding day itself.
Absolutely.
And that's Ezzy's role
there.
Do
you have a script to follow?
Yes, Aaron did give me a script. We've gone over the itinerary. I was actually practicing names yesterday because I have to introduce the groomsmen and
crash and burn is what comes to mind.
So many names.
Members of the wedding party, obviously.
Are you nervous?
No, I'm not nervous at all.
He does this for a living. He's on the radio. He's a professional.
I'm a wedding MC.
Do you have a suit ready to go?
You know you're going to have to wear pants.
What do you mean?
You have a suit ready to go for tonight? You picked it out?
Aaron never told me I had to have a suit. I was just going to wear what I'm wearing now, this T-shirt.
Has a big picture of meat on it.
I'm super excited. It's going to be fun. I'm really excited to go. I know that you guys don't have any confidence in me.
None.
But I know that Aaron and Julie have confidence in me. So, yeah, it's going to be awesome to celebrate their wedding today for sure.
There'll be something, all right. Hopefully we'll get some video of it later on. We can share that on illegalcurve.com. Let's talk about the Rick Nash trade from our perspective. We got a couple minutes here before Aaron's coming on to join us. How does Scott Housen, and we're going to ask Aaron
Portsline. By the way, that's Aaron Portsline, not Aaron DeGroote.
That's right. We're going to ask Aaron Portsline this question. But how does Scott Housen sell this trade to his fan base?
He hopes the fan base isn't watching and looking at this with a skeptical eye, because the truth of the matter is the guy had a better offer, really, arguably, at the deadline last year, shopped the deal around. And apparently the Red Wings made a big offer here, and they wouldn't trade Nash to an intra-division team. I hate that rationale. You want to get better. You're playing against 29 other teams. Don't worry about one team. So Nash comes and he plays well against you. That's fine. But does it give you more talent? If it gives you more talent, it is better for you. So if they turn down a better offer from Detroit because they were worried about Nash in the division, that's short-sighted.
I agree with that.
They look around, and you know what? Michael Arachi, Aaron Portsline's
colleague
at the Columbus Dispatch.
The columnist, I believe, is he?
Yes, the columnist. Yeah. And the Columbus Dispatch gives a lot of time to hockey.
Yeah, it's a very good newspaper. Aaron's great at his job.
Aaron's great. And what happened, and he's talking about how Aaron reported earlier in the year, how it all came to be. Basically, the Blue Jackets put Nash out there for a little bit, and Nash got wind of it. And that's kind of how it all, that's what precipitated his demand for a trade.
They put him out there even though he's got a modified trade.
They wanted to see what the interest level was in the market. He got wind of it, and then, you know, the relationship went sour. If I'm Rick Nash, I don't blame Rick Nash because of this. Because that team has been so poorly managed that I would have no expectation of winning in the foreseeable future if Scott Housen's running the show. So I actually don't blame Nash. What I do blame Nash for is, I realize he has a no movement clause, but if you're going to be demanding out of there and you're restricting it so much, I just don't think you should be treating the team that way on the way out. You know, like you give him such a significant list. Now, granted, the team really should be responsible for giving him the limit, you know, allowing him to have those limitations imposed upon them. So at the end of the day, it really does fall back on the team. But I would have liked to see Nash open up the doors a little more to other teams and give him a little bit better opportunity to become a better franchise moving forward without him.
Well, the offer that still, I mean, you know, that offer that Ottawa supposedly made still entices me more than what they got from him from the Rangers.
Yes.
Zibanejad, Lehner, and the first round pick.
Yeah.
What you would say there
is Zibanejad is the best prospect of the bunch out of anybody the Rangers gave up, and obviously the first round pick, and then you got goaltending, which has been an issue too.
You know, it's not the same thing, obviously, but you look at what the Milwaukee Brewers got for Zach Greinke yesterday.
Yeah,
they got I think the Angels' second, fourth, and ninth best prospects. Mm-hmm. And in baseball, you trade prospects, you know, for an established mm-hmm. player, mm-hmm. and this is a guy who's going to be an unrestricted free agent at the end of the year, in Zach Greinke.
Yep.
So I mean, and then Scott Housen is not getting the Rangers' top quality players.
Right.
He's accepting, you know, guys who are probably going to have reasonable NHL careers, but aren't top flight talent.
That's right.
I mean, and you're trading. Trading a dollar for, you know, for two quarters and a nickel.
Yeah.
Scott Housen gets ripped a lot for previous moves that he's made. As far as this trade goes, first off, I don't fault Rick Nash at all. I think he signed the 8-year deal. Was it 7 years or 8 years? The long term deal. He signed that contract. He could have gone elsewhere, and he signed that contract. Well, I mean, that's debatable, but he signed that contract under the assumption that this team was eventually going to get better. Not only did they not get better, they got worse, mm-hmm. and he stood there. He's an elite talent. He's one of the best forwards in the league, and I don't fault him at all, considering they were shopping him. Yeah, sure, I mean, he might have got, maybe, you know, the going public thing. I really don't have a problem with that.
It was an 8-year, $62 million contract.
Right, he's been overpaid for most of it. I mean, the guy doesn't put up enough helpers up there, and he scores, and he hasn't been scoring at a rate necessary to, I think, justify that contract.
But, Richie, having said that, playing, you put him with Richards,
and that should
80
help.
Points
that
guaranteed.
That should help for sure. Now, Richards is interesting to see how they perform at even strength, but I think that should help. It's a puck distributor. And Nash likes the puck on his stick, so Richards being able to get him that puck is obviously going to be important. That's why I never thought Carter, and we said it before, that the Carter even played with Columbus. I didn't think Carter and Nash would ever work, because they both want the puck on their stick, and they're both shooters. Richards is not a shooter. He's a passer. He'll get him the puck, and he should do wonders. You talk to people around that Columbus team, and they'll tell you, Nash, without any pressure, because there won't be much pressure in New York with all those other guys and all those other teams around, Nash, without that much pressure,
he's happy being a bit player.
Less attention. They say he'll flourish, and he's got the skill level to do it. So I would expect him to be that good.
I would expect him to be supremely motivated for this coming season as well.
I think so, Drew. I think that, and you know, because he hasn't necessarily performed to the level of the contract, doesn't mean that he can't in the future.
Let's leave it there. When we come back, the Columbus perspective. Aaron Portsline from the Columbus Dispatch joins us. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Shortly, 10 minutes prior to the top of the hour, you can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And the website is www.illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We welcome back to the program from the Columbus Dispatch, Aaron Portsline. Aaron, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing all right, guys. Thanks for having me.
As always, we appreciate you giving your time. Aaron, we had Andrew Gross on talking from the Rangers' perspective about 20 minutes ago. We wanted to get the Columbus perspective on the Rick Nash trade. You know, first question that I would have for you is, you know, after receiving what seems to us to be a better offer from the Rangers in February, how does Scott Housen sell this trade to the Blue Jackets fan base?
Well, first of all, the people here deny the accuracy of the February trade report. In fact, Housen has said emphatically that this offer that they accepted on Monday is better than any offer they had before. I think two things really moved this forward, and they're connected. Late last week, and I mean by that, I mean not this past Friday, but the Friday before when Philadelphia signed Shea Weber to the offer sheet, I think the Rangers really were compelled to do something because they know Philly's got something up their sleeve here yet this summer. So that pushed them forward a bit, and at that point, Erickson went into the deal. And then Columbus sweetened up their side a little bit with a third-round pick, and they finally had the match. We've been told, and I'm not contradicting anybody's reporting from New York because they may be hearing an exact opposite. But people way high in the organization would know what these offers are, if you know what I'm saying, have said that the offers that have been thrown out there as to what was available in February are not the reality.
Aaron, a big key. Necessities of this trade was taking back some contract, and Columbus took back Brandon Dubinsky. Now, obviously, Dubinsky his career was on the upward trajectory until last season's struggles, and he comes in obviously with a positive attitude, talking about how he's excited to be in Columbus. What role does this team see for Dubinsky? I guess both inside the dressing room and on the ice.
You know, Dubinsky's their best forward. I mean, I was thinking about that the other day, and that's probably a shocking.
Oh boy.
a statement for a lot of people, but he's their best forward. I think he's the guy that they see as a 25-plus scorer, which, you know, when the guy's coming off a 10-goal year, so that seems like a bit of a reach. But this is a guy, as you said, that was 20 goals, 24 goals the 2 years before. His role changed a bit last year in New York. He didn't play very well early. Even he has acknowledged that. But he's going to play a significant role here. They see him as a 20-plus goal guy and leave it at that. But in the room, more than the words that Brandon Dubinsky says, I think the fact that he's this guy who has earned a reputation as a guy who puts it all out there every night, that goes a long way in the room more than spoken words sometimes. And they've needed that so badly. And I don't mean just as a post-Rick Nash thing, they've needed that the last several years, where there have been times where you watch this team and the season is drifting away on them, and they come out and you just wonder, like, does this team really look like they're desperate right now? Where's the caring? Where's the passion here? And he's one of those guys that's never questioned with him.
Aaron, obviously Artem Anisimov was the other forward that came from New York, and you know, I guess people are talking a little bit less about him, but he's obviously shown us flashes, and, you know, he's shown us that he has the potential to be a top six forward, a consistent top six forward. He's obviously played on the top lines of the Rangers, top two lines. What needs to happen to, you know, to see him fulfill that role in Columbus? Because obviously he's still very young.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think one of the reasons the people are sort of down on this trade, and people by all means can have that right. I'm not trying to talk him up, but I don't think a lot of people in the West really understand who Dubinsky and Anisimov is or who Erickson is. They like Anisimov, I think, first and foremost as a shutdown guy, a guy that makes it very difficult. He's got a long wingspan. He's a pretty darn good skater for a guy his size. I think that's what they see in him first, and the goals are a plus from there. They think he's an 18, 20, and maybe beyond goal scorer. But you know what? You look at these Blue Jackets lines, they're not at all impressive. But there's a lot of sort of interchangeable parts there. And guys, I think, are going to be able to define their own roles, their own playing time, based upon their performances. There's not a number one line at all. There's a bunch of number two, number three line guys that they have to define. But I just get the sense that as this season goes on, guys like Anisimov, guys like Cam Atkinson, Nick Foligno, guys like this where you're not quite sure at this point where they belong, they're going to get a chance to define themselves and sort of dictate what kind of role they get.
We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show by Aaron Portsline of the Columbus Dispatch. Aaron, you look at the other piece that the Blue Jackets got, and that's Tim Erickson. He's a defenseman. He's only 21 years old. He's on his third team now, as it happens, after he didn't sign in Calgary, went to the Rangers. Now he's in Columbus. You know, if Ryan Murray makes this team as a defenseman, the first-round pick of the Blue Jackets this past year, does Tim Erickson get one more year of seasoning in the AHL?
Well, if I look at this team on paper, I'm saying to myself that it's going to probably be Murray or Erickson, but not both. I mean, their top four is fairly settled with Johnson, Wisniewski, Tootin, Nikitin. John Moore figures into the equation. Obviously, they signed Adrian Lecoin, a guy who's going to be in the NHL. Nobody's really sure how many games he's going to play. So there's six. And then, you know, Murray or Erickson. I think that if you lean one way or the other, you lean toward keeping Erickson, who's played in the pros already, who's got 1 year of pro experience. Murray can go back to junior. It'll be interesting. I also think it's still very open and very possible that the Blue Jackets seek to flip a defenseman here for help somewhere else on the ice. It may not happen before training camp or during training camp or even before the season starts, but I think they would be open to that. Question I have is, you know, what becomes of Erickson should the team send him back to Springfield because he was beat out of that spot by a kid coming straight out of junior, Ryan Murray? Does he head back to Sweden? I'm not quite familiar what his contract has in it. If he has that contingency, my guess is he does. But we'll see. The top four in Columbus is fairly well set. After that, it gets really murky in a lot of different ways.
Aaron, you mentioned the group of forwards. You know, you got Amberger, Davinsky, you got Brassard, Foligno, Johansson, Anisimov, a bunch of guys. You can put one of those guys on the first line. You can put one of those guys on the third line. It could work in both ways. It could lack obviously the top scores, but they could also have the depth to kind of contribute from all positions. So having said that, what kind of system do you think Todd Richards employs here with the team that he now has, which is significantly different than the team that ended the season?
Yeah, and I think it's significantly different than what he had in Minnesota as well. Mm-hmm. It's going to be interesting. There are no star players here. Maybe on the back end, I don't know if Jack Johnson counts as a star or not. It's going to be sort of a workman-like approach here. The system that they want to play, a swarming, hounding, go-hard, short-shift type of approach. I don't know that they're going to have a standard checking line either. I don't know who's going to center that third line. It's going to be, you know, I'm really interested to get into camp and to see what they have in mind, because there's going to be surprises. I mean, people are looking at these guys and saying, well, on this team, he's a definitely top six guy. Well, they've said that about eight different guys now. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be some sort of curious mix as to who's where. But in terms of systems, I think Todd Richards realizes that, you know, this can't be the team that he finished the season with last year, because they don't have the one big piece that's the focal point, Rick Nash. I think this team's going to go through stretches where they just can't score. I mean, none of these guys are proven scorers. We went through the league in the last couple of days and looked at team by team how many players on each team have ever scored 20 goals in an NHL season. And most teams have 6, 7, 8. Some teams have 9. Columbus has 3 guys that have ever scored 20 goals in an NHL season, and one of them's Vinny Prospel, who's almost as old as I am. So it's going to be a bit of a patch and seal and plug this hole and try to get by day to day, which, you know, is not necessarily an optimistic way to run a hockey team, but that's where they're at.
Aaron, last time we had you on, it was, I believe, June 30th. Is there 31 days in June? No, it was the day before July 1st, which was free agency. And since then, the Blue Jackets have acquired Nick Foligno. Sorry, I had to do some quick math there, Aaron.
That wasn't so quick, Andrew.
Slow math. What did you think of the Nick Foligno trade?
Well, I liked it. I mean, I like Foligno a lot, and Mathot, because of the situation here, it sort of became a traffic jam on the back end of the Blue Jackets blue line, and also I think this was the right time to move Mathot because he's a guy that a lot of people really, really like. I still think he has yet to put it together in his career. He's sort of a big guy who doesn't hit and a mobile guy who doesn't move a lot. He's just sort of caught in between and hasn't really defined himself. I think he can do that in the right situation. But Foligno's going back to like what you said about Dubinsky. I mean, I think this is the kind of character guy that they need, and I don't know him enough yet to assign the whole character tag to him, but I know this is a guy that plays hard, that's willing to do dirty work, wants to kill penalties, didn't do that a lot in Ottawa, has to cut down on the stupid penalties if you pay attention to what people who watched him in Ottawa say, but they need sort of scrappy, worker-like people in that room and on the ice. So in that respect, it made a lot of sense for me to flip it because, you know, Mathot was never going to be in the top four here given the way that they came together on the back end last year.
Aaron, after all the changes that the Blue Jackets have gone through, both at the end of the year last year and this offseason, does the team's success still hinge on getting quality goaltending this year?
You know what? Maybe more than ever, honestly. And that's the scary part. That's why a lot of people are down on this team. I mean, they figure to not score a lot of goals. I think that's a fair prediction that they will be on the, you know, in the bottom half of the league in terms of goal scoring. Well, you know, the guys on the other end of the ice, at least according to their play last year by Bobrovsky and the last 3 years by Mason, these guys need some margin for error, and I don't know that this team is going to provide it for them. I think the one hope, and this does make sense, I think, on paper, is that the defensemen should be much more defensively sound. They should be able to provide some sort of a tangled web system to defend better. The defensemen are better here in Columbus than they've ever been. So maybe Mason and Bobrovsky are seeing different shots. They're seeing lower percentage shots than they have seen in previous years. I mean, Mason has not been a very good goalie. The numbers will tell you that. And I'm not here to defend the kid because he was especially poor last season, in my opinion. But there have been lots of nights where you watch the proceedings and you say to yourself, there's not a goaltender who has ever lived that could survive with this kind of play. It was just such an abomination in front of him on the ice. And if that gets cleaned up, then who knows? Goalies have a long, long history. Every year when you think you know a goaltender, they surprise you. Mike Smith, great example this last year, but every year it seems like there's a guy like that. And the Blue Jackets are hoping Bobrovsky takes his turn next year.
Aaron, final question, pretty simple one. Is this team better than last year's team?
Well, it's really different. Yes, it's better because I don't think they're going to finish 30th again. So, yes, I'll say they're better. It's changed a lot. I mean, it's a totally different look now. Yeah, Steve Mason's still there, but look how the blue line has changed just in the last year. You've got Jack Johnson, you've got Nikita Nikitin, you've got Ryan Murray, Adrian Acoin. Those are all guys that weren't here last year. Position has an entirely different look with Rick Nash gone. I mean, that's going to be an odd sight on the ice for Blue Jackets fans to look out there and not see number 61 on the ice. They're so far different. I expect them to be more competitive, and I don't know if I mean that specifically with the results or just with their night-to-night basis. I don't get the sense that this team is going to roll over and die so easily as last year's team did in November, for God's sake. So they are better. I don't know if they're good enough to do much beyond the regular season, get there, in other words, but I would say that this is a better team, yes.
December 17th, Blue Jackets at Jets. We'll see you in Winnipeg in December, Aaron. Thanks very much for joining us.
I look forward to it. Thanks, guys.
Take care, Aaron. Thanks a lot, Aaron. Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290.